Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
From the John L. Santico Studio, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla, in for David Martin Davies. Today we're looking at the lives of jazz men Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie, and how they transformed not just music, but the entire country in its pursuit of civil rights. The three inspired countless musicians within jazz and outside of it. Here's a song by Stevie Wonder titled Sir Duke that mentions the impactful Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong, also known as Satchmo. Joining us today is Larry Tai. He's a journalist and author of the new book, The Jazzmen: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. I talked to Larry about these three iconic jazz musicians and their fight to be treated fairly and with respect during the Jim Crow era. Let's get into the conversation. So, Larry, you begin the book by talking about Louis Armstrong and his upbringing in New Orleans, Louisiana. New Orleans was one of the busiest markets for buying and selling slaves before the Civil War, and you write that the racial segregation in the city was, quote, as much by tradition as law. What do you mean by that, and could you help us paint a picture of Louis's upbringing in New Orleans?
Sure. So he grew up in a part of New Orleans that was so fraught with tumult and violence that it was called the battlefield. And for a young Black growing up then, it meant navigating a Jim Crow landscape of segregation that meant that there were separate water fountains and parks and libraries and schools for Blacks, and they were always second-rate ones. And he grew up actually, in my mind, having been rescued by what happened to him and seemed to him like the end of his life at age 13, when he was grabbed from the streets by police and thrown into reform school. And it was in that reform school that he learned how to do the one thing in life that guaranteed him that he would have a career and would have be celebrated rather than be disparaged the way he had been growing up in the streets of New Orleans. And that was initially learning how to blow a bugle and then a cornet and then the famed trumpet, on which he could hit higher notes than anybody had ever hit in the history of that instrument.
As you go on in the book, you continue exploring the backgrounds of Louis, Duke, and Count. When you talk about Duke, you mention his cotton club venue he would play at that resembled a slave owner's plantation. What did a night at Duke's cotton club look like?
A night at the cotton club meant that if you were Black and trying to get entry as a patron to hear the amazing music and watch the show there, that you were likely to be barred entirely. And if you were let in, you would be given a table next to the kitchen or so far in back that you could barely see the stage. And it was a plantation motif. The Cotton Club was the place that was trying to attract wealthy whites who were living in the center of the city, in the heart of Manhattan, trying to attract them to Harlem. And it did it by creating this motif that looked like it was the Old South. And they thought it was just a nostalgic thing. And in fact, it was an incredibly racist setting that Ellington and his bandmates certainly recognized. And the guys who owned the Cotton Club, who were mobsters, described the music that the Ellington Orchestra was playing by the disparaging term jungle music.
Thank you.
So it wasn't exactly the kind of setting that a proud young Black man from Washington would have relished. And yet he knew that this is what he had to do to earn his entry into the world of music then. And the fact that the Cotton Club had a radio hookup and that matrons in Kansas and school teachers in California could be listening to the Ellington Band every Saturday night was something that Ellington knew would help catapult him to stardom, and it did, but it came at a price.
Larry, you write that the Duke thought his, quote, jungle music was uplifting instead of demeaning to his race. Did he really believe that, or was he just trying to make it in the music business any way he could?
Partly he was trying to make it any way he could. Partly he was right that it was uplifting music and that it was a racist characterization, but a mischaracterization of the music. What he was playing was the great jazz numbers he would play throughout his career, and the idea that the people who owned the Cotton Club were trying to attract whites to Harlem by giving it this sort of this tinge of the dramatic and the little bit unsafe. That was precisely what they were doing, and they knew they were doing it. But what he knew was that he was playing great jazz, and he was letting people mischaracterize it, knowing that in the end, America would see that it was just great music.
Yeah, and you kind of touched upon this, but what did it mean for Americans all over the country, no matter their race, to hear these Black musicians on the airwaves?
Radio was the only way in those days you could hear Ellington. He wasn't cutting many records back then, and he was just starting out, and radio gave him a megaphone. He could be playing in Harlem and playing to America. And even when he and Armstrong and Count Basie started cutting more records, the way their music actually made it to national audiences was by the one medium that was available back then. It was by the radio, and the radio was the closest thing America had to a national hookup that brought us all together before the era of television and before the era of ensuring that music that was cut in a studio made it easily to people all across the nation.
Let's take a break right here, and when we get back, we can continue our conversation with Larry Tye. He's the author of the book, The Jazzmen. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be right back.
Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Give me what you alone can give, a kiss to build a dream on.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla. We're talking to journalist and author Larry Tye about his new book, The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. It tells the story of the three men who revolutionized jazz and made their way into mainstream America. Let's get back to my interview with Larry Tye. Could you tell us more about Count Basie's upbringing and his story?
Sure. So Count Basie grew up in a community an hour outside of New York called Red Bank. And unlike this Jim Crow segregated world by law of New Orleans, where Louis Armstrong had grown up, in Red Bank there was segregation, but it was more in fact rather than by law. And he grew up from the time he was a young boy and could envision what his life would look like. He grew up dreaming of getting the heck out of Red Bank. And he initially thought he would do that by joining the circus. It turned out he had a much quicker road to escaping and a much more attractive one, which was playing the piano. And he did that initially in the suburbs of New Jersey, and he eventually made it to New York, where he learned at the feet of the great jazz pianist named Fats Waller.
So you also write that Count first heard Lewis perform in Chicago in the mid-1920s, and he said that it was something else seeing him in person. And why did they never cut a record? Or, you know, Duke, Lewis, Count, why did they never appear on stage together?
All three of them were born within 5 years of one another at the turn of the last century. They all had careers that lasted a full 50 years, and they occasionally ran into one another, either in a recording studio or on the road. But I think the reason they didn't spend more time performing with one another and just hanging out with one another is that they had three decidedly different personalities. Louis Armstrong was over the top, and he wore his heart not just on his sleeve, but you felt his heart coming out from the bell of his trumpet. Count Basie was an incredibly shy guy, and he didn't like talking about himself, and he didn't like being at the center of attention, which was what made him a great band leader. He could bring out the personalities of his bandmates without worrying about his own ego. And Duke Ellington was, as much as Louis Armstrong was a guy who grew up essentially in the gutters and who raised himself up from a really difficult childhood, Duke Armstrong grew up in the black bourgeoisie. He had an aristocratic bearing from the time he was a kid. And the three of them were so different that it made sense that they weren't friends and didn't even perform a whole lot together. But more important was, I think, that each of them didn't want to share a spotlight. Whether you were the Count Basie band and you were the headliner in nightclubs across America, or the same thing for Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington, why share the spotlight if you could have it entirely on yourself? And there would have been questions about whose name came first in the billing, who got the biggest paycheck.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And while they all had a nomadic existence, they were constantly on the move. What was it like for them to be traveling musicians during Jim Crow? They weren't allowed in every hotel or restaurant. They had to really know and be cautious about where they stopped.
Sure. So I want to tell you a story about what they did to deal with that, which suggests the kinds of indignities they had to suffer. They were, when you were Louis Armstrong, you may be the headliner at a Las Vegas nightclub, but you still had to enter through the kitchen. When you were Count Basie, you may get 10 standing ovations the way he did one night playing at a Philadelphia theater. But when you came out of the theater, a white guy threw him his car keys, assumed he was the valet, and said, "Go get my car." Duke Ellington, when he was in Virginia and his manager was pleading with a white hotel to let the Ellington band spend the night, the hotel manager explained that he would have to add a surcharge for the room because, of course, at the end of the night, they'd have to burn the sheets and pillowcases so white guests would feel comfortable staying in a hotel that a black man had been staying in. And what they did when they could afford it, which was in the 50s and the 60s, they would rent private Pullman sleeping cars when they would go down south. And they may be performing in Atlanta, and that private, elegant Pullman sleeping car would be pulled off on a sidetrack. They would do their concerts, and then at the end of the night, they would come back knowing that they wouldn't risk a hangman's noose if they picked the wrong restaurant to try to eat in or the wrong hotel to book a room. And they would come home at the end of the night with the Pullman porters taking care of them, having a warm meal for them, having a plush bed ready. And in return, what those musicians would do is they would have a private jam session in the middle of the night for just the Pullman porters and the dining car guys. And it was a moment of magnificence. If I could go back to any moment in history, it might be in the closed capsule of a railroad car having a private concert from the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
I mean, it seems like it really did take a lot of persistence and tenacity to be on the road as Black men during Jim Crow. And for a lot of white jazz listeners in farming or mining towns, for many of them, seeing these men live was actually their first encounter with a Black person. What was that like mutually?
It must have been a moment of revelation. On the one hand, they had heard the music of these three guys, and that's why they wanted to be at the concert, and they knew what magnificent musicians they were. And on the other hand, if you're in a tiny farming village in Iowa or Kansas, and there are no Blacks living around you, it must have been a moment of revelation that, in fact, the sky wouldn't fall if Blacks and whites mingled in the same theater and you could listen to this kind of performance. And it also showed these three jazzmen and their bands what life was like in parts of America that they had never experienced, in rural white America, in cowboy towns and farm towns. And just the idea of both sides of the streets getting to see something that was novel to them. This, to me, is how racial progress is made. It's by having contact. It's by listening to musicians and realize they're not just great Black artists, they're great artists.
What was the demographic that was listening to Duke, Count, and Lewis? And did that audience change over the decades?
It did. So they were mainly playing to Black audiences at the start, which was understandable. Those were the audiences that felt comfortable with Black musicians and that had heard of these guys. Then they started playing to mixed race audiences in clubs that were known as Black and Tans. And then they started playing to mainly white audiences that could afford the high prices they were paying and that loved them as much as the Black audiences had in the early days.
Well, as I said earlier, these three musicians were constantly on the road. Louis Armstrong was quoted saying that 300 days on the road a year was normal throughout his career that spanned decades. So what were their personal lives like? Did they even have time to be present at home?
So all three of them were men of faith, that they were people who believed in God. They prayed before every meal and they read the Bible. And in Duke's case, he said he read it cover to cover three times. But we could go through commandments one by one and talk about how they broke them. And the one that is most dramatic is fidelity to their spouses. Louis Armstrong was married four times, and even with his fourth wife, he repeatedly cheated on her. Count Basie was only married twice, but he cheated on his wife enough that a couple times she walked out on him and only reluctantly came back. And Duke Ellington is the only one of the three who stayed married to the same woman his entire life. But they only lived together as husband and wife for a few years. And staying married to his wife meant that when all of his mistresses pushed him to marry them, he had this beautiful excuse: I'm already married and you wouldn't want me to have to go through an expensive and troublesome divorce. So they justified it by saying they were on the road so much. And that was the same case for lots of entertainers and politicians. I think it didn't make it any easier on their spouses who they were cheating on. And it was tough to live up to the Ten Commandments or to sort of remain pure. And they had various addictions. They had lots of things that were partly because they were on the road so much and partly because they just chose to do that. And to me, it made them in the end more flesh and blood and realistic characters and made them, in my mind, even more heroic.
What was their role and the role of jazz during World War II? Did their music uplift people during such a difficult time for the country?
So they did what a lot of entertainers did in those days. They entertained the troops by going to American bases here and overseas. And they reminded people, all you had to do, you listened to the music of Duke Ellington talking about what life was like in America and what romantic life was like in America. And it gave, for the hour or two of their performance, it gave American troops not just a sense of escape from their rough realities as being soldiers on the front line, it reminded them of the country that they were fighting for. And that's why the USO, the Servicemen's Organization, sent troops overseas, sent them these brilliant American entertainers. It was partly to say, in a not so subtle message, this is the home front, the country that you care about and that you're putting your life on the line for. And nothing was more all-American than jazz, and no jazzmen were more capable of lifting spirits and making you feel like you were in another place than Ellington, Armstrong, and Count Basie.
You also have a chapter on the white professional critics and reviewers who would not really review the music, but use this as an opportunity to be racist. Words used to describe this iconic music included savage, and many of them described their looks as animal-like and other racist descriptions. What were their responses to hearing things like that? I mean, they were just making music, and these were the types of reviews that people were putting out about them.
They knew how good they were, and their fellow musicians were telling them, and the idea that racist critics here and overseas were disparaging them was incredibly disheartening. But on the other hand, it made it even more uplifting when the critics finally came around to seeing them as not just black entertainers, but great entertainers and as geniuses. And it was no surprise to any black person who grew up in America in the teens and the 20s and the 1930s that there was racism out there. So it was less that they were surprised by those vicious critics as that they were just disappointed.
Let's take another break right here, and when we get back, we'll dive into the movie careers of these jazz musicians. They were in films like Hello, Dolly, High Society, and Paris Blues. They typically play jazz musicians, and just like the music critics, the movie critics often turn to writing racist reviews about these black men on the silver screen. We have all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
Magic spell you cast, this is love beyond rose. When you kiss me, I wanna play for my former pal. He runs the local jazz festival. His name is Dexter, and he's good news. Something kind of tells me that boy is nice in the blues. And high society. He's got the blues 'cause his former wife begins tomorrow a brand new life. She started lately a new affair, and now the silly chick is gonna marry a square.
Higher, higher, so higher, so higher, higher,
You are listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla, in for David Martin Davies. What we just heard is Louis Armstrong singing in the 1956 film High Society. He plays a jazz musician in this film, which is an adaptation of the 1940 film The Philadelphia Story. Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Duke Ellington broke into the film industry, once again making their way into mainstream America. But just like their music careers, their film appearances led to discriminatory remarks and critiques that had nothing to do with their actual performances. Let's get back to my interview with Larry Tye. He's the author of the book, The Jazzmen: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. So, Larry, could you talk more about how Louis, Count, and Duke broke into the film industry?
So they were pioneers in everything from making it onto the small screen of the television when that came around to the big screen. These were guys who were so good that they initially appeared on movie sets as musicians, and their band was playing sort of in the background. And increasingly, they started realizing, Hollywood directors realized that these guys had natural on-screen charisma. And so they started playing roles that were generally in character of them being a band leader, but having speaking roles. And over time, they actually were starring characters. And it was just unheard of back then that Black actors made it on screen at all, and that Black musicians made it out of their character as a music maker. And this was all part of what I think of as the quiet infiltration of these three guys into American culture. They became so much a part of every part of popular culture, from the radio and TV to the big screen to bandstands around the country, that Americans started realizing the potential for Black genius and started raising questions about Black humanity and unequal treatment. And to me, what I think was going on is that white men across America who would never have let a Black cross the threshold of their house were actually wooing their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Louis Armstrong or the Ellington Band, that white women who would have walked to the other side of the street if a Black man was walking towards them in the privacy of their own living room, kicked off their high heels and danced to the music, to the toe-tapping music of Count Basie. And this, for once, made race fall away as an issue, and people just wanted to listen.
Would you say that the, quote, criticism they received for their appearances in these films was similar to the criticism they received for their music performances, meaning that they weren't actually critiquing the quality of the performance, but instead made pretty racist remarks about them being Black men? I believe you included some of the film reviews in the book, and they really did mirror those of the music reviewers. And I think someone had said that Black and white characters shouldn't mix. Could you talk more about that?
People had a right, and critics had a right, if not a duty, to criticize them when they weren't performing well as actors or as musicians in the movie. But that wasn't what most of the criticism was. It was precisely what you said. It was the same racist lines and the same looking at them because of the color of their skin rather than the quality of their acting or performing. And it was just unfair. Again, the good news is that over time, the film critics realized the same way the music critics had, that these were geniuses and that they added to the film. And their fellow actors, the white actors who appeared on screen with that, knew that from the beginning, and it took the critics longer to catch on.
I want to talk more about Louis Armstrong in the 1956 film High Society, which is an adaptation of the 1940 film The Philadelphia Story. I want to play a clip of Louis acting in that film.
Man, dig that crazy rehearsal hall.
What a powerful pile of rock. Man, I can't go in there.
Why can't you go in there?
I ain't got my library card.
Dig you.
Are you the musicians?
That's what the man said.
Well, what name shall I say?
Tell Dex old Satchelmouth.
Well, please follow me, Mr. Satchelmouth.
Yes, sir. Wipe your feet, boys. Sub-dumb, we got a long, long ahead of us.
So, Larry, what did seeing these black men on the silver screen do for American viewers? I mean, this is a mostly white cast, and even the name itself, High Society. What was the significance of that?
People saw Louis Armstrong and saw the way, I think he was arguably the star of that movie, even though he wasn't billed as a star, that he was such a charismatic character. And I think it's not a big step to go from saying, geez, wasn't he good, to saying blacks can perform at the level or at higher levels than whites on screen with them, that whites on stage with them, that whites on the baseball field, that segregated society only makes sense as long as you can continue to deceive yourself to think that people have different skills and different mentalities. And when you start seeing genius in these black performers, it transforms your thinking. It slowly eats away at things. And you don't have to believe me in accepting that. Martin Luther King, in the early 1960s, in a little notice speech in Berlin, said that we would never have been able to integrate our schools and other parts of our society if it hadn't been for people like these jazz performers infiltrating American households and psyches with the notion that blacks deserve equal rights, and that it's never a straight line to get to social change. It's a zigzaggy line that includes three of the most brilliant blacks and best known blacks of the whole late 19th and early 20th centuries. These three, it was said in the 1950s and 60s that the two most recognizable Americans around the world were Mickey Mouse and Louis Armstrong.
Well, in the book you write that Duke Ellington was a little more reserved with his movie roles. He did almost no acting, but he did write the scores for or appear in 18 feature films and 41 television shows. Unlike Louis Armstrong, Duke was not dancing around and putting himself out there like Louis. He was more behind the scenes. For example, he created the score for the 1959 courtroom drama Anatomy of a Murder. And Larry, I'm really interested in learning more about Count's relationship with Frank Sinatra and how they toured together in the 1960s and what that meant for both of them. It kind of seemed like, you know, they were breaking barriers everywhere they went.
Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
Frank Sinatra was, in a way that few people realize, he was a racial pioneer. He was out there pushing for equal treatment of blacks, partly because he knew from people like Count Basie what brilliant performers they were. And when they went together to play in Las Vegas casinos, and Frank Sinatra, with his entertainment pals and with his underworld pals, was king of Las Vegas. And Frank Sinatra had one of his bodyguards go with Count Basie to make sure that he was not banished to entering the casinos through the kitchen, or was not treated poorly because of the color of his skin. And he basically made it clear, Sinatra, that knees would be broken, kneecaps would be broken, if anybody messed with Count Basie, that it was like messing with him. And their relationship, on stage and off, was to me an inspiration. And I never knew about Frank Sinatra, his role as a racial pioneer. And that just is one more reason for me to love Sinatra and his music.
Yeah, I didn't know the extent of Frank willing to protect and stand up for his black colleagues. I mean, I think I got hints here and there, seeing who he would collaborate with. But hearing that he would allow Count to be protected by his security is not something we hear a lot. But now turning back to Louis Armstrong and bringing in Ella Fitzgerald, how did she come into the picture?
Ella like so many vocalists who performed with him, had a blast. You could just tell on stage when they would trade off the singing roles, and Ella in her magnificent voice and Lewis in his raspy voice, the fun that they were having together and the idea that they really embraced one another was clear to anybody who was listening to their music. And I want to say just a word about Lewis's voice. The idea that somebody with a voice like Louis Armstrong could become the brilliant singer that he was incredibly unlikely. It was raspy. It was hoarse. Kids, when he was coming up in Chicago, which was the place that really launched him, the kids would, in the middle of winter, roll down the windows of their car and stick their head out to try to catch cold so they could sound like Louis Armstrong.
I want to now listen to a clip of Louis Armstrong when he appeared on the show What's My Line? This is a show where contestants are blindfolded and they have to try to figure out the celebrity guest of the week. And this week, it was Louis Armstrong. And the way it works is that the participants had to ask questions to Louis to try to figure out who he is. But because his voice is so recognizable, Louis didn't really answer their questions with words. He would use grunts because he knew that if he spoke, they would immediately know. So let's listen to that clip right now.
Am I correct in gathering that you're a representative of the male sex?
That was a yes.
That was a yes? Are you grunting this way because if you talk, we would probably recognize your voice?
Yes.
Would you be in any possibility connected with the world of music in some way or other?
He's left.
Is that a yes?
That's a yes too, yeah.
I just have a wild idea. Do you play an instrument yourself occasionally?
Yes.
I don't know what that means.
That means yes. Mm-hmm.
Would you, by any chance, have a very famous nickname that is known all over the world? Something like Satchmo?
Let's take another break, and when we get back, what a wonderful world. Or at least, that's what Louis sang about. But did he really believe it after his endless experiences with racism and discrimination? That's coming up on The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Above you, night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me. Say nighty night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you'll miss me. While I'm alone and blue as can be, dream a little dream of me.
Stars fading, but I linger on, dear.
Oh, how you linger on.
Still craving your kiss.
How you crave my kiss.
Now I'm longing to linger till dawn, dear. I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla. We just heard the song What a Wonderful World, sang by Louis Armstrong. The song became a widespread, optimistic tune, but Louis didn't always agree with its words, especially after having lived through Jim Crow. We're talking to Larry Tye. He's the author of the book, The Jazzmen: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Let's get back to my interview with Larry. So, in your chapter, Resetting the Themes, you talk about Louis's reaction to first reading the lyrics to What a Wonderful World. I mean, I think when we hear that song, we all think, oh, how beautiful, how optimistic, he's such a beacon of hope, of light, for sharing these words. But when Louis first read the lyrics, he said, what is this? Can you tell us more about that?
That a guy who grew up with the kind of racist indignities that Louis Armstrong had to suffer through in New Orleans and for the rest of his life, the idea that he could sing a song with such conviction talking about it being a wonderful world suggests to me that he was an amazing optimist. And he looked at the progress we'd made, not at the persistence of racism. And I think he brought that kind of upbeat sense of the potential and the potential to make things better that made him not just a convincing singer and player on the song Wonderful World, but that made him as the kind of informal ambassador that America sent around the world, including behind the Iron Curtain, when we were engaged in a heated Cold War with the Soviets. That Louis Armstrong and Duke Ellington and Count Basie were wonderful embodiments of the American potential, not for what we had done in our worst side, but in the fact that we could get better. And that's what they told the world everywhere they went. They said, yes, we've got problems in America, but we can fix them. And that song that you point to, Wonderful World, captures that better than anything I can think of.
Well, how were Duke, Count, and Louis perceived overseas? What was their global impact?
So they started out by going to England and to France and to a couple other places in Europe. And initially, in the reviews, some of the reviews that you read earlier in our conversation, some of the reviewers judged them more by their race, the same way they've been judged back home. But over time, they got a warm enough reception in Europe and then in Africa and in Asia and in Eastern Europe in what was then the Soviet Union. The response was so warm that all three of them contemplated at various points, do we really want to go home to all the racist garbage that we have to deal with, or would we want to become expatriates and maybe stay in a place like Europe? And they contemplated that, and they thought about it seriously, and especially when Louis Armstrong went to Africa and he was greeted in a kingly fashion, they thought about it and they realized in the end that they were Americans, that they were not just performing this all-American kind of music and jazz, but that they belonged in America with all of its warts, and that they were going to be not just the patiently and passively take the abuse they were dished out, but that they were going to fight back and become warriors for racial equality. And they did that.
You end the book with the last few years of Louis Armstrong's life. What were those like?
Yeah, so the last few years of his life, he was suffering issues having to do with a weak heart and things that had troubled him throughout his life. But until almost the very end, he was performing. He only came off stage, not when his doctors told him to, but when he basically couldn't stand up on stage anymore. And he died going out, listening to incredible music, performing amazing music, and staying at home in his house that is now a museum in the Queens section of New York, which has the house put together in exactly the way it was when Louis Armstrong lived there. And I suggest to any of your listeners who make it to New York to put on, it is the rare museum that's not just a collection of memorabilia, but that actually in the structure itself shows you how somebody lived. And to see how Louis Armstrong lived with a bathroom, with mirrors on all the walls and the ceiling, with a kitchen that looked like it was out of the Jetsons, a space-age kitchen, and with a study that had the latest state-of-the-art recording equipment, it showed you who Louis Armstrong was until his very dying days.
I really feel that we cannot overstate the impact that they had in the progression of non-Black Americans viewing Black people as people. How did Duke, Count, and Lewis open up the world for Black jazz musicians today?
They opened up the world by showing that Louis Armstrong showed what a trumpet could do and what his voice could do. Duke Ellington showed what his 6,000 compositions that are played today on jazz stations and in jazz clubs across America. And Count Basie showed in a band that survives to this day just how great a band could be. And what they did was they inspired not just today's jazz musicians, every one of which talks about how they stood on the shoulders of these three greats, but they inspired everybody from Bob Dylan to the Beatles. And I'll just end with one story, which is that Paul McCartney was asked by the Louis Armstrong House and Museum to help them raise money. And he so adored Armstrong that he said he would do that, and he did it, if the Armstrong House would do something that they did, which is lend him for a weekend one of Louis Armstrong's trumpets, just so that he could have it there and toot the horn a bit, and so he could have his great, you know, role model, Louis Armstrong, in his home for a weekend. And that's how much musicians of every stripe in America adored these three greats.
Well, Larry, what do you want people to take away from this book? What should people know about these three jazz men?
I want people to remember, when they listen to the amazing music of these three, that they did a whole lot more than play music. They used to all say that they wanted their politics and their outlook on life to shine through with their music, but they never stopped there. They were out there on the front lines of the civil rights battle. Many people, young militants, called them Uncle Toms, and that was exactly the opposite of what they were. They were out there striking a blow for Black artistry and Black humanity in an era when that was a life-threatening thing to do. And I want people to just recognize that these guys had as impressive a legacy off their bandstands as they did on.
That was my interview with author Larry Tye. His new book is The Jazzmen: How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm Kayla Padilla. Thank you so much for listening.
Much more than I ever knew, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think.